Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
It's Friday, which means it's time to learn something new. Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast. I'm your host, Catholic Answers apologist and speaker, Trent Horn. And here on Free for All Friday, we love to learn about new and interesting things to edify you, to give you new facts to share with the world, and just to have a little bit of fun. As those old public service announcements used to say, knowledge is power. And that's one of the things that definitely powers this podcast, along with our gracious supporters at TrenthornPodcast.com. For as little as $5 a month, you get access to bonus content, exclusive ability to comment in the community at TrenthornPodcast.com to talk about these episodes, and you get access to other bonus content like our study series and the ability to submit questions for our open mailbag episodes. You want more access to that? Be sure to go and check it out at TrenthornPodcast.com. So today I'm dipping into a well that I often enjoy talking about, and that is geography, learning more about our Earth. I remember when I was in the sixth grade, I was in a geography B. I think I've talked about this many moons ago. I mentioned this on here on the podcast. And I was in the sixth grade. I came in second place, so I didn't get to advance to go on to the state finals. It's kind of like those kids. If you were in a spelling bee, remember this. Were you ever in a spelling bee at school? And if you were, do you remember the word you misspelled? I think almost everybody does. You know, ironically, I remember the word that I misspelled in the kids' spelling bee, like in the fourth grade. It was competent. There you go. Well, of course, that's a word that you should competently be able to spell, right? But I was not able to do that. I got further in the geography B. Didn't go all the way, didn't go the distance, but I had a lot of fun being a part of it. And I've always enjoyed studying geography and learning about our world ever since. So the theme of today's episode is the most remote places in the world. It's the most far out places on our Earth that are really hard to get to, or you can only get to them under unusual circumstances, and some places that nobody's ever been. So strap yourselves in, let's fly over to some of these places. And while we're flying, two things I want to talk about are dealing with airplanes and getting to the most remote places on Earth, because there's certain places where airplanes don't fly. One of these is the Himalayan mountain range in Nepal and China and Tibet. So why not? I mean, think about this. Imagine if you were taking a business flight over to Australia or Asia or Abu Dhabi, and they said, you know, for just an extra $500, extra $1,000 on your ticket, you can be on the plane that flies right next to Mount Everest. You can fly over Mount Everest and catch a view of the tallest mountain in the world. So would you be willing to pay a little bit extra to fly right next to the tallest mountain in the world and look out your window and say, hey, look, honey, there's Mount Everest down there? Well, here's the thing. You're not going to be able to do that because commercial flights and aviation do not fly over not just Mount Himalaya, but the Himalayan mountain range. They don't do that. But why don't they do that? I mean, that would seem really cool, right? You could just fly over, Mount Himalaya, Mount Everest. Did I really say Mount Himalaya earlier? My brain is a bit scrambled eggs right now. I just went to a wonderful Indian lunch buffet place before recording this podcast, so I think I have veggie korma on the mind. So wouldn't it be fun to fly over Mount Everest and take a look at it? And you think you should be able to because Mount Everest is about 29,000 feet up in elevation, but airplanes can fly at around 35,000 feet to 40,000 feet. Around 35,000 feet is an average cruising altitude for a commercial airliner. So you've got 6,000 feet. You can fly right above Everest. You have room. So why don't commercial pilots, why don't airlines fly over the Himalayas or give you a scenic view of Mount Everest? Well, there's several good reasons that they don't do this. First, there's a problem when it comes to glide error. So if something happens to a plane, especially if it loses all of its engines, if a plane's engines just stopped working, if it had just complete engine failure or systematic engine failure, you lose one engine and then you lose another. If a plane's engine stopped turning, the plane doesn't just fall to the ground. It becomes a glider. A few episodes ago on Free For All Friday, I talked about the Gimli glider in Canada. It ran out of fuel, but the pilot was a former glider pilot. He was able to glide the plane to land at an old runway that had been turned into a drag race strip. So if a plane experienced a catastrophic failure of its systems, it wouldn't just fall out of the sky like a rock. You would be able to glide it, and you've got a decent amount of time in many cases to glide it to a safe airport or a diversion airport. But the problem is if you're flying over the Himalayan mountain range, even if you're at 35,000 feet, you don't have that much room for error. If you're flying over Kansas at 35,000 feet, the plane is going to drop, 1,000 feet every few minutes or so. So for example, a lot of planes might have a lift to drag ratio of 10 to 1. So for every 10 miles of flight the plane goes without its engines, it will lose 1 mile of altitude. So if it's flying up at, you know, 36,000 feet, a plane could probably glide for about 60 to 70 miles to be able to find a safe runway. So you have a lot more room for error here. You got 60 or 70 miles. But if you're flying at 35,000 feet and the mountains underneath you are at an elevation of 20, 25, or 29,000 feet, well, then your room for a glide error is really, really low. You have a few options to go to. And if you're flying over the Himalayas, there are hardly any airports that would be able to take a commercial flight. Even Kathmandu, which is in Nepal, it's a pretty rundown airport. I actually had a friend who was considering doing missionary and educational work in Nepal. And so I was looking at the travel arrangements to go and meet him in Kathmandu back in my pre-marriage days, of course. Now, the only adventures I go on in relation to the Himalayas is taking my wife to Himalayan cuisine here in La Mesa, California, where I can get wonderful veggie korma, as I alluded to earlier. But even without the glide error problem, if you were in a commercial airliner above Mount Everest or above the Himalayas and you experienced maybe not engine failure, but let's say you had a cabin depressurization problem, there is a leak or a seal or a hole opens up in the fuselage, that's not always fatal to the aircraft. If there is a failure in cabin depressurization, then you have to get the airplane down. Remember, at 36,000 feet, there's really no air for people to breathe. You're going to pass out in probably a few seconds. That's why the oxygen masks come down and your flight attendants say what? Put on your own mask first before assisting others, because you don't want to put a mask on your child and fiddle with it, because if you pass out and then your child passes out, nobody is there to help. You put on your own mask first, because at 35,000 feet, you only have a few seconds of oxygen left. When climbers climb Mount Everest, they carry oxygen with them into the death zone to go to the top of Mount Everest, because there's not enough oxygen there to sustain human life. So normally, if a plane is at 35,000 feet, experiences a cabin pressurization fail, it would dive quickly to 10,000 feet where you can breathe. You have enough oxygen at 10,000 feet. I mean, you might go to some places and get altitude sickness or mountain sickness, but at 10,000 feet, there's normally enough air for people to breathe and you won't need your oxygen mask anymore. And you would dive down quickly to do that. But if you're flying over the Himalayan mountain range, it could take you 30, 60 minutes, an hour and a half. It could take you a while before you can get to 10,000 feet of altitude. And those oxygen masks you have in the plane only have about 15 to 20 minutes of oxygen in them. They're not meant for you to breathe the entire time. It's just for the pilot to be able to get the plane down to a lower altitude to deal with the pressurization problem. But over the Himalayas, that emergency option would be unavailable to quickly dive to 10,000 feet. So that's why commercial airline pilots do not fly over extremely high, dense mountain ranges like the Himalayas. Another reason is that the turbulence would be terrible. I mean, whenever I fly into Denver, even places like Albuquerque, when I fly over the mountains, there's always a bunch of bumping and people don't like that. So if you're going over the Himalayas, the turbulence would be a nightmare to deal with. And finally, if you did crash in the Himalayas, rescue coming to find you might be extremely difficult, if not impossible, because it's so remote and arduous terrain. That's another reason that planes don't fly over Antarctica, though Antarctica is actually something that's opening up. I believe Qantas is thinking they're always trying to push the limits when it comes to long distance flights. So they just opened up a recent one from New York to Sydney, and I think also from London to Perth. So they're really pushing their flights to go 19 hours. I think 19 hours is now the longest flight they have, the one from New York to Sydney. There's another one that goes from New York to Singapore. I believe that's a similar length. But they, or another airliner, they're actually looking at trying, I believe it's Qantas, they're trying to get a flight from Perth, Australia to Buenos Aires, Argentina. If you look on a map, actually, most planes will fly along kind of the Antarctic corridor and go under South Africa. They won't go right over Antarctica. They'll take advantage of the polar winds, those currents, and go that way, because also there's a lot of diversion airports and it's just safer. If you fly over Antarctica and you have problems, the current ETOPS regulation, ETOPS refers to extended range operation with two engine airplanes. I've talked about it before on the podcast. If your engines fail, most planes have like 180 minute diversion. It's gone up over the years. They say if you're going to fly with two engines, you got to be within, it used to be 90 minutes of an airport to divert to in an emergency, but it's gone up to now, I think, like 3 hours or 4 hours. They're trying to get these planes better and better so these two-engine planes can get a 330-minute ETOPS, which means you can fly this two-engine plane, you just always have to be within like 5.5 hours of a diversion airport. So that puts you 5.5 hours would put you like 3,000 or 4,000 miles. I mean, that's how long it takes me to fly across the contiguous United States, like when I fly from Baltimore to San Diego. So right now, the outer limits of ETOPS prevents planes from flying over the South Pole. They can fly over the North Pole, and there's a lot of planes that do that northern polar route because there are places that they can divert. Like, there's a lot of military bases with decent runways. You've got Resolute in northern Canada. Alert is another base. I don't know if they could take a 747. They might be able to. You could go to what used to be called Barrow, Alaska, which has now been renamed. I can't remember its name right off the top of my head. Across the North Pole, you've got other diversified routes you can go to. The South Pole is kind of a different matter. But I think planes, they're eventually trying to get some to go across there. And if they do, I'd love to be booked on that to fly over Antarctica and check it out. I just hope it's not a repeat of Air New Zealand Flight 901. Yeah, I know. Trenton plane crashes. He's obsessed. He's a crazy guy. Mount Erebus was Air New Zealand Flight 901 was a sightseeing trip where they would take people to see Antarctica. But the plane, the company changed the travel coordinates on the plane the night before and didn't tell the crew about it. So it ended up crashing into Mount Erebus, and most of the pieces are still there because it's a giant pain to go down to Antarctica and get everything. They found the victims. There are no survivors, but a lot of the pieces were left there. This was back in November 28th, 1979. All right, so we've seen where planes don't go, which are pretty remote, though Antarctica might get crossed off the list soon here in the 2020s. What about other places that are pretty remote? We were speaking of the Himalayas. That brings to mind the world's highest unclimbed mountain. So you've heard of Mount Everest, of course, very famous, tallest peak in the world. It's actually not the most dangerous peak in the world by far. A lot of people have died on Mount Everest because so many people go to climb it. But K2, which is another peak, is actually much more deadly. K2 is the second highest mountain, and I think that it has a far greater fatality rate. Perhaps the deadliest mountain in the world is Annapurna. It's in the same range there in Nepal. More than 130 people have climbed it, but 53 people have died trying. One out of every three people who climbs Annapurna ends up not coming back. So it's easily the most dangerous mountain in the world, but it has been climbed. The highest unclimbed ones would be two peaks around in the same area, China, Nepal area. First is Gongar Pensum. It's in Bhutan, on or near the border with China. In Bhutan, the climbing of mountains higher than 20,000 feet has been prohibited since 1994. The rationale for this prohibition is based on local customs that consider this and similar peaks to be the sacred homes of protective deities and spirits, and the lack of high-altitude rescue resources from any locale closer than India. The prohibition was expanded in 2003 when mountaineering of any kind was disallowed entirely within the nation of Bhutan. So Gongar Pensum is about 24,840 feet high in the nation of Bhutan, right next to China, has not been climbed, may never be climbed if that prohibition on mountain climbing remains. There is one peak that it's legal for people to climb, but it's incredibly dangerous. Nobody's ever summited it, and that would be Muchu Shahish. It's a mountain in the Batura Mutsag subrange of the Karakoram in Pakistan-occupied Kashmir. So the name of the mountain is Muchu Shahish. It's 24,449 feet tall, about 5,000 feet less than Mount Everest. It's located in a very remote and inaccessible region. Only a handful of attempts have been made to reach the summit, none successful. The most recent attempt was in 2014 when an English mountaineer, Pete Thompson, turned back at the 20,000 foot point. Muchu Shahish is one of the tallest mountains on Earth that remain unclimbed and is possibly the tallest one of all that is not off limits due to religious or political prohibitions. So if you want to be the first, maybe you will be. You who is listening to the podcast want to climb Muchu Shahish, though I would say, as Jesus said when it comes to building a tower, count the costs. Count the costs. Is it really worth it to do that? Next up, we're coming down from the mountains to the islands. If you look at a globe, what are some of the most far away places? I love just looking at globes sometimes and seeing, you know, these random places that you find on them. And now that I say that, you know, when you look at a globe and find all kinds of random things, another Simpsons clip pops in my mind that I have to share with you. It's from Bart versus Australia, one of the best episodes of The Simpsons, in my opinion. And Bart learns from Lisa, who's wrong, by the way, Lisa isn't right about everything, about the Coriolis effect, which it's true in the southern hemisphere. Hurricanes, well, they call them cyclones, they spin the other direction because of the Earth's rotation. Because it's in a different hemisphere, the cyclones spin the other way. So in the northern hemisphere, hurricanes spin clockwise, but in the southern hemisphere, cyclones spin counterclockwise. But she tries to say that toilet, though you've heard this one before, the water in your toilet will spin differently if it's in the southern hemisphere. That's not true, actually. In order to, you'd have to have a giant body of water to notice the effect. So if you had a tub of water that took 24 hours to drain, then perhaps you would see its the spinning of the drain as the water leaves would actually be a different direction, but not in a toilet bowl. That's not, you know, the direction it spins is caused by the angle of the nozzles and how it, the tank water empties into it. But then Lisa tells Bart that's how it is in the southern hemisphere. And so Bart just looks at a globe and starts pointing out random things in the southern hemisphere.
So down there in, say, Argentina or Rand McNally, all their water runs backwards?
In fact, in Rand McNally, they wear hats on their feet and hamburgers eat people.
And so, of course, Rand McNally are the groups that make the globe. It's not a country that's out there. But when you look at globes or you look at Google Earth, which was pretty cool, Google Earth, it used to be a map you would see, you know, it was just a like a Mercator projection. But anytime you try to take a globe and stretch it out into a flat surface, you always get distortions. This has befuddled map makers ever since they started making maps. There's always a distortion when you take a globe, a three-dimensional object, and try to transpose it onto a two-dimensional surface. So with the classic Mercator projection on a map, you get some things that are correct, like the ratio of distances between places, but the size of areas are greatly expanded. So Greenland looks like a monster of an island when it's actually much smaller. And the same is true for Antarctica. But anyway, so imagine you're looking at a globe on Google Earth. It's all very interesting. And if you look, you take, go to India, and then you go south from India for several thousand miles across the Indian Ocean. You think, okay, there's nothing out here. I'm just going to end up hitting Antarctica. But you keep going south, and eventually you run into the Kerguelen Islands, also called the Islands of Desolation. So look at the Kerguelen Islands in the southern Indian Ocean. They're thousands of miles away from anything. They're called the Desolation Islands. They're cold. They're windy. They were discovered by Jevs Joseph de Kerguelen Tremarec in February 12, 1772. And now there's about, I think, 50 to 100 French researchers and scientists who stay there. So you can use Google Earth to zoom in on the Kerguelen Islands and see the little town they have there. And there are a few ironic reviews for the one hotel on the town, which is just for people, you know, there's a boat that'll take you there, I think, once every 3 months, basically. So be ready to be checked in for a long time. And there's a church, actually. There's a church there. I don't know if it's a Catholic church or not, but it sounds like one. And it has a wonderful name, Church of Our Lady of the Winds, because it's in the polar zone and it is windy and cold there all the time. I love one of the reviews for the hotel on the Kerguelen Island. On the one hotel, it says, best hotel for miles, because anywhere else you would go is still thousands of miles away. So check that out on Google Maps, the Kerguelen Islands. You want to go there, you can't fly there. There's no airport. You'd have to fly to probably to Madagascar and then take a boat for several days before you would be able to get there. But it's smack dab right in the middle of nothing. Another set of islands that are in the middle of nothing, the Pitcairn Islands. Officially, there's four of them. Pitcairn, Henderson, Duchio, Nueno are a group of four volcanic islands in the southern Pacific Ocean that form the sole British overseas territory in the Pacific Ocean. The four islands are scattered across several hundred miles of ocean and have a combined land area of about 18 square miles. Henderson Island accounts for 86% of the land area, but only Pitcairn is inhabited. The nearest places to it, so it's basically in the southern Pacific Ocean, you know, between Polynesia and South America, says that the nearest place would be the Polynesians to the west and Easter Island to the east. Pitcairn is the least populous national jurisdiction in the world. The Pitcairn Islanders are a biracial ethnic group descended mostly from nine Bounty mutineers. Remember Mutiny on the Bounty, HMS Bounty? Well, they're the descendants of these people and the handful of Tahitians who accompanied them, an event that has been retold in many books and films. This history is still apparent in the surnames of many of the islanders. Today, there are approximately 50 permanent inhabitants to the island, originating from four main families. Though a lot of people who are on the island are not permanent residents, they're tourists. And you too can be a tourist to lovely Pitcairn Island if you want to go and stay there or visit just for a bit. Pitcairn tourism focuses on small groups coming by charter vessel and staying at homestays. About 10 times a year, passengers from expedition-type cruise ships come ashore for a day, weather permitting. As of 2019, the government has been operating the MV Silver Supporter as the island's only dedicated passenger cargo vessel, providing adventure tourism holidays to Pitcairn every week. So that's an update. It used to be the only way you could get to the Pitcairn Islands was by a supply ship that went every 3 months. But there's a lot of people who just want to get away from it all. And you go there, when I've seen videos online describing it, you feel like you really are just on an island in the absolute middle of nowhere. It has kind of a, you know, tropical climate year-round, and as it's a very quiet island atmosphere. But I also think there is an active volcano on the island, so you might want to check that out before you go there. So two islands are in the middle of nowhere. If I had to pick between the Kerguelen Islands and the Pitcairn Islands, I'm going to go with the lovely Pitcairn Islands. Though, for bragging rights, to go to the Island of Desolation and to pray at Church of Our Lady of the Winds might tempt me to Kerguelen Island. So check that out on the Globe and read some of the reviews of people who have been there. All right, now I've got two more remote places I want to share with you, and they are not your tropical islands. They're not your frozen islands either. They're on the mainland, but they sure are frozen and away from everybody. These places are still really remote. You can visit if you want to. They're easier to get to than Pitcairn or the Kerguelen Islands. I believe they have, well, one of them has an airport, the other does not. The first, I'm pretty sure, has an airport is Longyearbyen, Norway. So this town, Longyearbyen, Norway, is the largest settlement and the administrative center of Svalbard, Norway. As of December 2015, the town had a population of 2,144. So Longyearbyen is really far north on Norway. It's on the archipelago of Svalbard, which is like right there up at the north, into the deep in the Arctic Circle. It's only about 800 miles away from the North Pole. It's a place where it was founded, I think, primarily for coal mining. But one thing that a lot of people talk about Longyearbyen, and they think that it's kind of an urban legend around the place, is people say that it's forbidden to die there, like it's illegal to die in Longyearbyen. That's not true. In Longyearbyen, Norway, it's not illegal to die, but if you seem chronically ill, like you're getting sick and you're about to die, they don't have long-term care facilities there, so you just get sent back down to mainland Norway for treatment. If you did happen to die there, however, accidentally, let's say you were attacked and eaten by a polar bear, which is something people have to watch out for, they don't bury you there because the island is covered in permafrost, so bodies wouldn't decay. They wouldn't decay. There might be something polar bears would try to dig up. So they don't end up burying people in the permafrost in Longyearbyen. They either cremate them or they send the body back down to Norway, to the mainland. So this provision here in the town, because of its climate and because of its soil, has led to some interesting scientific research. According to mentalfloss.com, which is a great website if you want to learn random trivia, some century-old bodies in the local cemetery still contain rare remnants of the 1918 influenza virus that killed around 40 million people. So remember in 1918, they had the Spanish flu epidemic, killed tens of millions of people. And it affected people all the way up in Norway, even in Longyearbyen. And there are people who were buried there, you know, way back at the beginning of the 20th century. And they're still preserved in the permafrost because the ground never gets above freezing. It says in 1998, researchers visited the graveyard to gather samples of the virus's genetic material. The findings were extremely valuable and have helped scientists better understand how to combat similar cases in the future. The research could save millions of lives. And if you're planning a trip, don't believe the rumors that this virus could spread to visitors. The communication advisor for the town said, "This is not an active virus and is not considered a threat, but you should watch out for polar bears." Nonetheless, the author of the article opines at the end. So that's one, Longyearbyen, Norway, deep in the Arctic Circle, north of Norway. The other one is probably, it's in Siberia, one of the coldest towns in the world, if you want to make it there. I remember learning about this town it's been showcased on a few shows on Netflix. One is World's Most Dangerous Roads. And there's a lot of dangerous ones. You know, you go into the Amazon trying to drive through the jungle or mountainous passes. This one, though, takes the cake as the most dangerous. It's just the Road of Bones paved in Siberia by gulag workers. And it's the Road of Bones because a lot of them died in the process of making it. It's frozen throughout the year. And I'm talking, it is cold. And the road leads to Omyakon in the Omyakonsky district of the Sakha Republic of Russia, located along the Indirka River. I have really messed that up, so hope my Russian listeners don't get mad. Oh, another show that I saw on Netflix were Going to School. It was a great series on kids who had to go to school. So one was like kids who had to paddle their way through lakes and rivers of Peru to get to school. The other one was for kids who had to walk in Omyakon, Siberia, in like negative 30 degree, negative 40 degree temperatures to get to school. And that's what these people deal with all the time. It says since World War II, the population has shrunk significantly. The village had a peak population of 2,500 inhabitants when it was the central town of the region, but the number has decreased to fewer than 900 in 2018. There is a monument built around the town square commemorating a reading in the 1920s of negative 96.2 degrees Fahrenheit. This was shown on the Australian program 60 Minutes in a 2012 documentary. On February 6, 1933, a temperature of negative 89.9 degrees was recorded on Omyakon's weather station. This was the coldest officially recorded temperature in the Northern Hemisphere. Only Antarctica has recorded lower temperatures, negative 128.6 degrees at the Vostok Research Station, July 21st, 1983. So I hate the cold. I lived in the Midwest. If I ever left San Diego, I go right back to Phoenix. I'll take the heat over the cold any day. Maybe you feel differently. If you prefer cold over heat and you're a patron, let us know in the comments at trenthornpodcast.com. But to round it out, as the most remote places out there that you've probably never heard of, Omyakon, Siberia. And now one last bonus question for you all. What is the most isolated major city in the world? So think of a city with more than 100,000 inhabitants, and what is the most isolated city you can think of? Do, 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 do. Think of, you know, 100,000 people, but it's away from everything. And it's a city you probably have heard of. Number one at the list, Honolulu, Hawaii, about 3,850 kilometers from Daly City, California. Number two would be Anchorage, about 2,000 kilometers from Vancouver, using kilometers, because that's what the reference I have here uses it in. You can estimate miles the best you can. After that would be Perth, Australia, which I've been to. You go to Perth. Perth is a large city. It's a beautiful city. It reminds me of the San Diego of the Indian Ocean. But man, there is nothing around Perth. There's like tiny mining towns and stuff, but there's no other big cities. Like Perth is just way off on its own in Australia. Lovely city. Glad I've been there. Would love to return, hopefully in a few years, for speaking events there. The other ones would be Reykjavik, which is off in Iceland, and then Petropavlovsk Kamchatsky over in northeastern Russia. Well, hey, I hope this was helpful for you all. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoy Free for All Friday. If you like the show, be sure to visit iTunes, Google Play, leave a review for the podcast. Otherwise, I hope you all have a very blessed weekend.
If you like today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit TrentHornPodcast.com.